Professor David Skeel is the Samuel Arst Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He holds a JD from University of Virginia and a BA from the University of North Carolina. He's a frequent commentator on radio and television and in newspapers. And in addition to numerous articles in law journals, he's the author of two books, Icarus in the Boardroom from Oxford in 2005 and Debt's Dominion, A History of Bankruptcy Law in America from Princeton in 2001. His research focuses on bankruptcy and corporate labor law, but also covers sovereign debt law, religion, and poetry in the law as well. We're delighted to hear him speak today about a work in progress entitled The Unbearable Lightness of Christian Legal Scholarship, which I know many of you have read. Professor Skeel, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much to you, Eric, and Alan, and everybody here at the center. It's just a great joy to be here. I missed an opportunity to come a couple months ago to the conference that is posted right on the wall over there, and I'm just thrilled to have a second bite at the apple to get another chance. So this is an article that I think of as being an article about Super Tuesday, at least in a very loose sense, in a couple of little elements of it. The starting point of the article is what I perceive to be a surprising mismatch between the political influence of conservative Christians in this country, particularly in the last 30 years, on the one hand, and on the other hand, what seems to me an almost complete absence, not complete absence, but almost complete absence of a well-developed Christian legal scholarship, in particularly in the major law reviews over the last century. In the past, political and legal movements in this country, like progressivism and New Deal and the cluster of movements that were centered on the New Deal, moving up to more recently the conservative movement, all have been very much reflected and well represented in the legal scholarship. So in the progressive era, there was a deep literature in the major law reviews on progressive issues and from progressive perspectives. Similarly, more recently with the work of people like Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia with respect to the conservative movement. But when you look at Christian perspectives, particularly with evangelicalism, but with conservative Catholic scholarship as well, in the leading law reviews over the last century, there is remarkably little evidence of those movements. And so the questions I ask in this paper are, why is this? Why is it that there seems to be so little Christian legal scholarship in the leading law reviews? And what lessons should we draw from the absence? The article answers these questions in two ways. The first is historical. I examine the history of Christian legal scholarship over the last century or so and try to answer the question, what happened? Where did the Christian legal scholarship go, and why is it so little in evidence? Second thing I do in the second half of the article is to look forward and to ask what a more well-developed Christian legal scholarship might look like. And in this second part, looking forward, I offer two examples of the kinds of scholarship I hope we'll see in the coming decades. The first is a normative theory that's somewhat related in some ways to some work Greg has done, that Bill Stuntz and I have been working on, and which we call the modest rule of law, or a modest rule of law perspective on the proper role of the secular law. And then the second that I talk about is a descriptive theory that responds to what I refer to in the article as the Bono puzzle in the international debt relief movement. And for those of you who are not quite the right age, I'm exactly the right age to know who Bono is. Probably everybody knows who he is now. He's a rock star. One of my secret ambitions of all this work was to try to meet Bono. That has been a colossal failure to date. I thought I had it all lined up. I was teaching a class on debt relief last year, and Bono came to not only to Philadelphia, but Japan. And so I got our PR person to contact his PR person. I thought, you know, maybe you can stop by for 5 minutes. He did not stop by for 5 minutes. So it was back to the academic trenches. So again, there are two parts to the article. The first part is historical. The second part is looking forward to what Christian legal scholarship might look like. The one thing that the two parts of the article seem to me to have in common is that they have both proven quite controversial in some circles. At least I've been criticized for both parts of the article in a pretty helpful way, I think. I think it's improved the article, and hopefully our conversation will continue to improve the article. I have a few more months before it will actually be in print. So what I'll do for the next 10 minutes or so, I'll try to be as quick as I can, but also get enough of the article out for those of you who haven't had time to read it, is just walk through each of those two parts of the article, the historical part and then the looking forward, a vision of Christian legal scholarship part. To put my historical argument on a slightly firmer footing, I spent a big chunk of last summer, surveying all of the published articles in the elite law journals from 1900 to 2000. Now, for much of the 20th century, if you were asked the question, what are the elite law journals, your answer would be there were three of them. It was Harvard, Yale, and Columbia were the elite law journals until the last 20 years or so, really, 20 or 30 years. So I started with those three. I added five more law reviews. I looked at Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Michigan, California, Chicago, Penn, Virginia. I think that might be all of them. I also looked at Northwestern, and I'm gonna expand this over time, I think. But what I found when I looked at these articles over the last 100 years is what you would probably expect if you had to have a sense of where Christian legal scholarship is. And that is that after about 1910, there were almost no articles in the leading law reviews that whose title at least reflected a discernibly Christian perspective. There were few in the first decade or so of the 20th century. After that, almost the only thing you would see would be the religion clause literature. Most of that was not specifically or explicitly from a Christian perspective, but dealt with Christian inflected issues, but almost nothing else in the leading law reviews. And so the first half of the article is devoted to developing an explanation for why this might be so. The first part of the explanation is that in law, it seems to me, as in other disciplines starting in the late 19th century, there were a series of reforms that were designed to try to make the law more scientific. The watchword in the progressive era and both before and afterwards was scientific. You wanted the law to be scientific so that movements like Christopher Columbus Langdell's legal science and Roscoe Pound's sociological jurisprudence and legal realism all talked about making law scientific. Religion was viewed consistently as antithetical to a scientific jurisprudence. And this is quite explicit, that religion was thought of as unscientific and as inappropriate for modern legal scholarship. So the first part half of the explanation is that there was a quite concerted effort to remove discernible religious perspectives from the legal literature, at least in the most elite law journals in the late 19th century through much of the 20th century. The other half of the equation is Christian legal scholars themselves, and especially evangelicals. Evangelicals, as exemplified by William Jennings Bryan, who I talk about a fair amount in this piece and in another companion piece, and whom I think of as sort of the Mike Huckabee of his time, magnified, multiplied by about 10 or 20 times. He was 10 or 20 times what Mike Huckabee is. Is a good example of what evangelicalism looked like. It was populist, it tended to be anti-intellectual, it tended to be hostile to elite scholarly circles for much of the early 20th century. For the first few decades of this time, it did exercise political influence. So evangelicals were very influential on prohibition and other social issues at the time. But after about 1925, evangelicals dropped out even of that. Not only were they did they tend to be anti-intellectual and hostile to intellectual elites, but starting in about 1925, evangelicals turned their back for the most part on American politics and law. And the reason that I, like other folks, choose 1925 as a dividing line is that was the year of the Scopes trial, which cast evangelicalism in an unattractive light. It was also the year that Bryan died. He died a few weeks after the Scopes trial. Catholic legal scholarship was a very interesting counterpoint to what was going on in evangelicalism. It was both very different in some respects and quite the same, at least in my view, as to the ultimate effect. It was different in the sense that there was a real legitimate Catholic legal scholarship for the entire 20th century. And this, the Catholic legal scholarship flourished particularly in the 1930s and 40s in jurisprudence departments and in law schools. This was a period when Catholics were attacked, as they had been previously, but the attacks really increased, were attacked as undemocratic. Catholicism was seen as authoritarian and hostile to American democracy, and there was a whole movement often associated with John Dewey that was designed to emphasize American democracy almost as a substitute religion. Catholics were in the firing line. In the midst of this, there was a fascinating war of words between a group of Catholic scholars such as John Ford and Francis Lucy were a couple of the main ones on the one hand, and on the other hand, defenders of Oliver Wendell Holmes and of the legal movement known as legal realism. There was a heated debate with the Catholic scholars saying that Holmes was, it wasn't Catholicism that was anti-democratic, it really was Holmes. It was Holmes that was giving comfort to authoritarianism because Holmes seemed to disclaim any a role for morality, and if you have no role for morality, there's nothing that we can do to defend against Hitlerism, is effectively what these scholars were saying. And they said it quite explicitly. There's some remarkable quotes, a couple of which I give in the paper. Striking thing about this to me is both that there was this very well-developed natural law influence scholarship, but also that it had very little direct discernible effect on the elite law journal. So that one of the main defenses of Holmes was an article in 1951 in the Harvard Law Review. If you look for the Catholic responses, they're not in the Harvard Law Review or the Yale Law Journal or the Columbia Law Review. They're in the law reviews of the Catholic law schools. They're in the Fordham Law Review, the Georgetown Law Review, and places like that. In my view, that is at least in part because there is this continuing hostility to religious-oriented scholarship, even in the mid 20th century, and the religious perspectives were regularly dismissed, at times derisively, and I quote a line from the end of the Howe article, and he's actually not especially hostile to religion. He later wrote a book that was not unsympathetic to the influence of religion in American culture, but in this article defending Holmes, he says, if we allow religious perspectives back in particular if we allow religiously oriented natural law back in, we'll have to throw off those old shackles all over again. You know, we'll have to rebel again and fix things again and get rid of religion all over again. As a result of these developments, of the hostility to religious perspectives, evangelicals sort of turning their back on American culture in general, on the legal literature in particular, there's very, very little Christian legal scholarship for most of the 20th century. And kind of in the middle of the article, I talk about a couple of the exceptions to this. The biggest exceptions are, not surprisingly, the religion clause literature. Most recently, that's reflected in the work of people like Michael McConnell. The other big exception is the natural law literature, which is in its most recent iteration in the legal literature is often identified with John Finnis and the work of Finnis. But outside of those areas and a couple other areas, almost no Christian legal scholarship in at least the most prominent law reviews. So that's the history. More quickly, what about the future? Here I argue that a lot of current Christian legal scholarship doesn't seriously engage the best secular legal scholarship, and in fact is appropriately dismissed. And this is the sort of thing that gets me into a little trouble, and one could say the same thing about my own work. That in one version of this article I did say the same thing about my own work. I cited one of my articles and I said, here's a good example of something that's not real Christian legal scholarship. I love the article. It's an article about Saul and David, the narrative of Saul and David in the Old Testament, that applies that narrative to corporate takeover law, of all things. It was great fun to write the article. I'm quite fond of the article. I also believe that if you cut the Saul and David stuff out of it, nothing that I say about corporate takeover law couldn't be said, just saying it about corporate takeover law. So I have some stuff in that part of the article that's gotten me into a little bit of trouble, but I stand behind it, and that is, again, that a lot of the existing literature doesn't really seriously engage the best secular scholarship, and it needs to if it's going to be serious Christian legal scholarship. Even more controversially, and I try to say this gingerly, and I don't entirely mean it, I suggest that the areas that cry out for exploration lie not so much in analytic philosophy, which seems to me to have a magnetic attraction for a lot of Christian legal scholarship, but in other areas, and in particular in the use of economics, political science, sociology, and other disciplines to shed light on the law and the relationship between these disciplines in theological thought. These are the kinds of things that I think Christian legal scholars ought to be doing, or not that they shouldn't be doing analytic philosophy, but that there has been a lot of very good Christian legal, or Christian philosophy, not so much legal philosophy, in recent decades. There has been much less in these other areas, use of sophisticated institutional analysis together with a theological perspective. And it seems to me that these are the sorts of things we ought to be doing. And the way I put it in another article is, in the early 20th century, Roscoe Pound, who was the founder of a movement called Sociological Jurisprudence, and he was the dean of the Harvard Law School for about 20 years, argued that what legal scholars needed to be doing was using sociology and economics and political science and really looking at what actually happens with the law, not thinking of it solely in abstract terms. He was kind of excluding religion from that statement, and one way of looking at what I'm arguing is to say, if you injected religion back into the kind of jurisprudence Pound was at least talking about, I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of there are a lot of issues that folks like me and Greg and others, I think, can begin to explore. And so I give a couple of examples of the kinds of things I have in mind, which I alluded to earlier. One is on the normative side. I talked briefly, in addition to talking again about some work, a wonderful article that Greg published a year or so ago, and some other stuff that other folks have done. I talk about this modest rule of law idea that Bill Stuntz and I have been developing. The argument here, I won't go into it at length, we can talk about it some more in a minute if we'd like, but the argument here is that theologically conservative Christians in this country have tended to assume that secular law should be coextensive with morality, that if we can identify something that's immoral or sinful, the next move ought to be to try to prohibit it criminally, typically. The argument we make in the first argument that develops this theme, and I develop it some more in this article, is first of all, that can't possibly be squared with the Sermon on the Mount and other Christian teachings, and we talk about the image of God and the idea that we are all sinful. When you put those together, it can't possibly be the case that the goal of the secular law should be to police everything that we can identify as immoral. And we argue that it also has proven very, very counterproductive to take that kind of a stance, a kind of a stance that suggests that if we can identify immorality, we ought to stamp it out. We give a number of historical examples, starting with everybody's favorite example of a law that went awry, prohibition. We talk about gambling a little bit. We talk about corporate regulation in the other article. I don't talk about it here. We talk about abortion, and we give a couple of other examples as well. As I said, I can talk about that in more detail if anybody's interested. On the descriptive side, I try to begin to explain this phenomenon I refer to as the Bono puzzle. And what I have in mind when I use the expression Bono puzzle, in addition to trying to set myself up to meet Bono, which I haven't completely given up on, but you know, he's got bigger fish to fry. He needs to talk to Bill Gates. I was very jealous when I read Bill Gates' speech at Davos, when Gates was articulating his idea of a kinder, friendlier capitalism. A very interesting speech. At the end of the speech, he talks about how he was in a bar having a beer with Bono. And I thought, you know, there's something's wrong with this picture. We should be having a beer with Bono. In any event. So the puzzle is that the debt relief movement, starting in the 1990s, was a huge political movement in England, and it was a movement that was directly and explicitly associated with Christians. It was at its core a Christian movement. The main organization involved was an organization called Jubilee, which was playing off the Old Testament idea of the Jubilee. So it's a huge movement in England. There's an article that I cite in this paper that refers to it as easily the biggest social movement of the last 25 years, or something like that. You cross the Atlantic to the U.S., and nobody cares about the debt relief movement, least of all the most politically influential Christian groups in this country. And so the question I ask is, why is that, at least until Bono gets involved? When Bono gets involved, all of a sudden, people start caring a little bit. He talks to the Clinton administration. He causes Jesse Helms to cry and to change his view on funding things like AIDS initiatives in Africa, and has a similar influence in the Bush administration. Why is this? And I developed the very beginnings of an explanation. It is just the beginnings of an explanation. It seems to me that a couple factors are key. One is just the different nature of religious influence in this country. In this country, we don't have an established church, and it seems to me that affects the way religious influence is manifested. But that's not really a complete explanation here. I think probably more important is simply that evangelicals, since about the 1920s in this country, have been very hostile to social legislation, using the law to try to deal with social issues. In the 19th century, they weren't hostile to it, but in the last 80 years or so, evangelicals have been hostile to what looks like social legislation to deal with issues like poverty, and I think that's a big reason why debt relief has not resonated here. I do think that's changing, at least a little bit, and I think the Huckabee campaign is a small example of that. I don't know that that's going to go all that far, but I'm also a little more optimistic about this than Alan is. Alan's written about some of the problems when evangelicals like Rick Warren go out and try to change the world and some of the mistakes they make. I agree with Alan about that, but I also believe that as evangelicals like Rick Warren and the people who are inspired by people like Bono go to Africa, they're going to come back different. And I think this hostility to using legislation to deal with social issues is, and this is an uncharacteristic optimism coming out from me, I think it's going to change the nature of evangelicals in American politics, at least a little bit. And I think that may be what we're starting to see in various areas now. So let me stop with that. I've gone a little longer than I was supposed to, I think.
That's all right. Thanks. Thank you very much.